Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Sarah Egge about her book, Women's Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, 1870 to 1920. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on the New Books Network. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Sure. So I'm originally from South Dakota. I grew up in South Dakota and went to my undergrad. Institution, North Dakota State University. And then I went to Iowa State University. So I like to say I'm a product of the Midwest. I'm someone who, grew up with cold winters and summers with not so much humidity. I think in many ways that experience shaped my interests as a historian. I was very much interested in the place, this region in which I had lived. I lived in a number of different states and just really had a lot of questions about why the communities that I had lived in were the way they were, why people talked about things the way they talked about them. And so for me, that was a pretty important part of my upbringing that led me to think about, as I got more interested in history, what I ultimately wanted to study.
Was it a direct line between that interest and this book, or did you initially consider, or did you initially approach other topics before you started to discuss, before you started to look at this one?
Yeah, so I was generally interested in women's history and really thought that I was going to end up doing something with one of the more famous women's rights activists, or that I would look at a particular element, maybe of the suffrage movement, but not necessarily in a particular region. But what happened was I had as a senior undergraduate at North Dakota State, I had an independent study, and I read all these books about women's suffrage and about women's rights activism, really kind of the late 19th and 20th century. And I realized, I was talking to my professor, I said, well, where's the scholarship on rural women and on women in the Midwest? And she just said, well, there isn't really much. There's some, but there's not a whole lot. And so that really piqued my interest. So here I am, I don't know, 22-year-old senior in college. And I've sort of, that was it. I thought, well, this is really what I want to do. I want to explore this. I want to say something and figure out what's going on with women's rights and then in particular women's suffrage in the Midwest. And so for me, I just felt like there was a gaping hole there. And I wanted to explore that.
One of the things I took from reading your book is just how large that hole is. It seems like there is so much work to be done. And what you do in your book is you're talking about women's participation in civic affairs and the suffrage movement in South Dakota, Iowa, and Minnesota. And you focus in particular upon three counties, Clay County in Iowa, Lyon County in Minnesota, and Yankton County in South Dakota. I was wondering if you could explain perhaps why you chose those three counties. I was thinking about that as I saw you have in your book a map of each state with the counties all outlined, and the fact that you highlight where each county is. And I was struck by the as I was reading it, how you chose this county and why not the neighboring counties, or why not say, maybe counties closer to the capitals or something like that.
That's a great question. There's a couple of reasons. So when I went to graduate school, I went to Iowa State, as I said, and I knew I wanted to do something with women's suffrage, and I wanted to look at rural spaces. So that meant that while I could have looked at maybe the capital cities or counties where there was a larger town, and let's be honest, this is relative to the Midwest and to these particular states, the population's not very dense. I could have done that, but what I wanted to really understand was what it was like for rural dwelling individuals, really farm families, or people whose lives were rooted in agriculture. So I wanted to do that. And then I sort of had a meeting. My advisor, Pam Reinickerberg, she said, well, hey, you should talk to this retired history professor. Her name is Dorothy Schweder, and she does a lot of work. She did a lot of work with Iowa history. You should just get her insights on what she thinks you should do. So I just went over. We had a lovely, I think she had like cookies and tea, and we just sat in her living room. And I just remember she's like, well, if you want to talk about this, you really need to pick a county that will represent sort of this sort of experience of rural local communities. You also need to make sure you find counties that have great local archives and repositories. And so that was really something I also keyed in right away. But then she also made this point. She said, you also want to think about how do these three, at that point, I decided I was going to do three states. So she said, if you choose a county in each state, how do they speak to each other? And so she kind of made this point, and I developed it further, that I wanted to choose counties that had similar settlement histories, similar economic outlooks, somewhat similar demographics, which is important for the argument that I make, especially around the idea of gender and ethnicity. And then ultimately, then the sort of the factor that's different was this idea of the political climate, especially then as it related to this how women's suffrage unfolded in each county. One of the arguments I make is that, especially in the Midwest and really across the nation, women's suffrage was experienced through local communities. But in particular, in the Midwest, that's how women understood their activism, was on behalf of their communities. So it was kind of this combination of recognizing that if I was going to make this argument and I wanted to understand how women came to their activisms, I needed to look at these local communities. So then I again went back and I made sure that these counties had great local archives, which they did. Yankton County, Lyon County, and Clay County all have some sort of county historical societies. Some of them have even sort of small town public libraries or historical societies that have their own small collections. And those were vital. And so once I sort of surveyed and recognized that these places all had similar histories, except for their interactions with women's suffrage, but then they also had these collections, for me, that was sort of the way I figured it out. If you also I'll just say that the geography, if in this sort of tri-state area of South Dakota, Southeast South Dakota, Southwest Minnesota, and Northwest Iowa, they're all actually pretty close to each other, again, in a Midwestern relative sense. Midwesterners, we have no problem driving 3 or 4 hours to do something. And so they have, if you are in Clay County, Iowa, and you talk about Marshall, Minnesota, which is the county seat of Lyon County, Minnesota, people are like, oh yeah, we know where that is. We might even know someone there. So even though they're in these different areas, there's this broader shared regional tri-state identity in particular in that place.
Hmm. I'd like to go back to something you were talking about a moment ago, which was this idea of the context in terms of the societies in which these communities were located. Could you take us back to the late 19th century in the Midwest and describe what these communities were like who the populations were and what were some of the issues and norms for those times?
Sure. So the first group of people who came in larger numbers, they came mostly after the Civil War. Certainly there were people, I should say, of course, there were people living in this area for generations and generations and generations. So it's really what we're talking about are white settlers who are coming. And there were some before the Civil War, but they start to come more in larger numbers after the Civil War. And these are primarily Yankees. I borrow this. Other people have talked about Yankees in the Midwest, so I'm using that label. And these people are generally middle class. They're white, Anglo-Saxon in particular. They're usually Protestant. They're educated and they're elite. And they have a tie to the Northeast and really, in particular, New England. And so they come to the Midwest, again, in large numbers after the Civil War, with a particular goal. In part what they say this as their own words, they want to basically institute civilization as they see it, but a particular vision of civilization, one that prizes community, civic engagement in particular. So they love volunteerism. They love public institutions. They have all of these fraternal societies that they recreate in the Midwest. The Masons and the Odd Fellows and all these different groups. And they immediately begin in their minds building this vision of civilization. And a key component of that is that you should be civically engaged with your community. And the other cool thing or interesting thing is that it's gender inclusive, meaning that Yankee women are working alongside their husbands. Yes, often in different ways, right? They're working more often for causes related to education. So they'll be pursuing public school building. They're going to be building libraries. They're also working a lot. I talk a lot about this in their churches. But they're engaging in this public work of community building and settling. And it gets public recognition, and they build these reputations that are incredibly valuable once women's suffrage starts to unfold in this particular context. So when I talk about Midwestern political culture, I'm situating these Yankee women who will then become Midwestern suffragists, kind of the leading activists. They come out of this particular moment of Midwestern settlement and the expectation of civic involvement. So they come first in larger numbers, and they continue to move into the Midwest throughout the late 19th century. At the same time that immigrants, mainly from Europe, particularly from Northern Europe, are coming to the Midwest. The largest numbers are coming predominantly from two groups, Germans and then Scandinavians, which I know are made up of Norwegians and Swedes and Finns and other groups. So they come to the Midwest again in the late 19th century, and they're primarily seeking land to farm. We have the Moral Land Grant Act of 1862 that makes it somewhat easy for them to acquire 160 acres of land. They have to work it for 5 years, and then they basically get it. And so this is a huge lure for them to come to the Midwest. But as I talk about in the book, what it does is it creates a particular characteristic of the settlement that starts to shape the political context, and then ultimately woman suffrage. These immigrants will settle together in enclaves. They will settle often with ethnic identities intact within these enclaves, and then there's religious identities as well. So, for example, Norwegians are typically Lutheran. They will settle together in a small enclave, kind of out on the prairie. And what that does is that gives them a different sense of community than these Yankees. These immigrants see themselves as part of this community development, but their goal is in many ways to maintain their ethnic identities, their cultures. So you have Norwegian Lutherans, you have lots of Germans, you have German Lutherans and German Catholics, you have lots of other groups, but these religious and ethnic ethnically defined enclaves start to pop up across the Midwest. My favorite analogy, it's like a patchwork quilt where they're all sort of, it's not the pretty, you know, there's the grid system, but they're all within there, sort of haphazardly around, and they disrupt this Yankee notion of civic engagement, in that, yes, they want to be civically engaged, but not on this, in the same ways that the Yankees would like them to be. And because of this enclave culture, they can maintain a lot of their ethnic traditions. So they're speaking their native tongues for a long time in the Midwest. They are raising their own food so that they can then produce a lot of their sort of cultural values. They're practicing holidays from their ethnic cultures that Americans are not celebrating. And then for them, really, rather than these sort of public institutions like school and library, for them, it's their church. That is their sort of nexus, their hallmark of identity, and it reinforces both the religious and ethnic values that they seek to perpetuate in the Midwest. And so Yankees and these European immigrants are living together. They're often working together on various enterprises, often economic growth. That's a big part of this. They're settling and they're trying to develop the Midwest and create these sort of agriculturally defined states that will benefit both the states, the region, and the world and the nation. But they're doing so sort of within these various ethnic and religious communities. And so, as you can imagine, there's this tension that's infused in this settlement process. And it plays out then in the political landscape as well, when you start to get at some of the interesting ways that immigrants at this time are expecting to then engage on this in the political landscape of the time.
You have delineated some of the basic differences between the two groups. Were there any differences when it came to the gender norms of the time in terms of how they viewed women and the role of women in their respective societies?
Yes, there were. So as I mentioned, Yankees had more of a gender inclusive vision for their community engagement. And again, they certainly worked often on separate initiatives, women did, than men, Yankee men. And so there is, it's not to say that it's gender equality. I try to make that pretty clear, but it is more inclusive in that they can partner, work alongside Yankee men. For the immigrants, there is not that expectation for immigrant women in particular. And it depends on the particular immigrant group. Norwegian women, we see that there's more inclination to include them. There's often more, especially with women's suffrage, there's a little bit more willingness to support women's suffrage, not necessarily early on, but later in the early 20th century. But often we see, especially, for example, with German women, that expectation of partnership and sort of more inclusive gender norms, that's not the case. So you do see, again, sort of a break between women in terms of if they're immigrant or if they're Yankee. And so that's something to note. Above all, though, I will say that gender norms in the 19th century were still very much that women should be in the home, that women should be concerned mostly about childcare, about food preparation. In this agricultural context, there's definitely a lot of sliding in terms of how women are. They're working in barns, they're working in fields when they need to. So there's not necessarily like the rigidity that we would think of, but the expectation, the prescription is there that women should be sort of separate. I do make this point, though, that the idea of separate spheres, while it holds weight, it's not the reality for many of the, in particular, these rural women. A lot of them, whether they're Yankees or they're immigrants, the work that they're doing, the engagement in particular in their communities, gives them access to the public sphere, gives them more of a sense of belonging within these sort of more inclusive, again, sort of more equal, but not, it's not necessarily like true gender equality. And so, yeah, so it's, yes, there's these predominant ideas, but it gets complicated when you actually look at what women are doing. And then there certainly are differences between Yankee women and immigrant women.
That's one of the things that you do in your book that I thought was especially interesting, was you describe how women take the area of the public sphere that is open to them and in effect use that as sort of a foothold into a much larger role of activism later on. You describe how these traditional activities, things like, say, community fundraisers, end up giving them a grounding that they then translate into broader social activism, even prior to the campaign for the suffrage.
Yeah, that was actually one of my favorite chapters to write. It was so interesting because often, so there's in the historiography, there is this sense that the Midwest was really not favorable to women's suffrage, that most women were not interested in it, and that largely these campaigns were failures. While that's true, that a lot of the amendment campaigns, the initial ones didn't see victory. There was support that slowly developed over time for women's suffrage, and the way that it developed and how these women who will become suffragists frame their activism comes directly from their community involvement. It's quite subtle. I think other historians have overlooked it or not understood how vitally important it was and how it counts as activism. So one of the things I did was to then uncover this. And so I looked at women in their community involvement, the activities that they did, and I found that they're all over the place. They're working in all of these different ways. One of the groups that I talk a lot about are ladies' aid societies. So these would have been women's groups associated with the church. They could be mission societies, so they had different names. But in general, these ladies' aid societies would fundraise for their churches. And they would have bazaars, or they would have socials, they would have picnics, and they would raise money. It seems sort of quaint, right? I think people sort of think, well, that's women's work. And it is. But what's amazing is they raised huge sums of money, and they used that money to, again, engage in the public sphere. So in their churches, you know, they're going and they're buying expensive furnishings. They basically hold the money. So if men want anything done to the church or any changes that they need to make, they have to go to the Ladies' Aid Society. They have to go to the women and ask for it. And I looked at some of the meeting minutes for these Ladies' Aid Societies, and you can tell that it's really the women who are they're not necessarily the leaders of the church in terms of, like, if you looked at the, you know, the elders or whatever, they're not listed, but they're the ones that are giving permission for whatever the church leaders want to happen. And I have a number of examples of that in the book. And I just think that it's the collective effort of these women to control the finances through their own work that gives them this incredible power, and it accumulates over time. It's tied to this point I made earlier about reputation. They get these great reputations in their churches that starts to, again, give people the sense that, well, women have this power, they have this authority, and we respect them for it. And then it starts to get into these arguments about, well, then women with this authority and power and respectability, well, then, yeah, they should have the right to vote. So I think that's really great. They do it in other ways too. Federated ladies' societies, women's clubs. This is incredibly popular. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was very popular and important in the Midwest. And these groups, they do very similar things, and they accrue over time this incredible social capital that gives them this claim to the ballot.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I was reading that chapter in your book, which is how it worked in both the practical and the abstract level. On the practical level, they're getting the organizational skills. They're learning how to fundraise. It's helping in effect to give them the realistic groundwork for running campaigns like you see with temperance and prohibition and then suffrage. But it's also, and this is what I thought was especially illuminating, that that theoretical aspect, that they're making the case for their role as citizens in a way that is both acceptable in their communities, but at the same time is then raises this question, well, then why is this barrier? Why does this exist here? If women can go up to this point, why can't they just go beyond that point and become full citizens?
Exactly. Yeah. So one of my favorite ways of sort of envisioning this. So there's a campaign in South Dakota in 1890, and the Ladies' Aid Society of the Methodist Church in Yankton County is going to have their annual fall bazaar, and they have it downtown. It's this huge community event. It's well attended, and this is totally normal. Everyone's like, yep, we know what's happening. You walk in, there's quilts on the wall, there's handmade, you know, there's tons of goods, there's food, there's an entire meal. And so this is totally normal. And that year, that fall, here comes Anna Howard Shaw, you know, well-known suffrage activist, a member of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, or NASA. And she gives a speech at the bazaar. And I just love this idea that for these women, they're making this subtle yet powerful argument that we do all this work for the community. It's totally recognized. You have no problem with it. And we're going to invite the suffragist and make this point that, again, we are citizens. We understand the responsibility of uplifting our communities, building our communities. And therefore, yeah, it makes no sense why we can't take it a step further and get the right to vote. And I just love that. It sort of illustrates how these women, again, make this subtle yet powerful argument that they should have the right to vote.
One of the other things you do in your book is you talk about the relationship between the movement for prohibition, the WCTU, and suffrage. And it's one that other historians and other authors have talked about in the past. But what you do in your book is you situate it within the context of these three states and these three communities. And it helps to show how the lines on the suffrage movement came to be formed. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon that, the role that the women in these three communities played in the WCTU and these campaigns, and how that defined, to a certain extent, how these different communities you've described, the Yankee and the German Scandinavian immigrant communities, came to view the role of women in these, in public affairs.
Sure. Yeah. So a lot of these Yankees are also members of the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And so temperance is by far the political issue of the Midwest. It's one of obviously the major ones in the United States and the 19th century. But for in particular in the Midwest, this is the animating question. And I like to think that I like to point out that it's not just about abstaining from alcohol and other behaviors that encourage vice, right, and that are corrupting, but it actually goes to this question that starts to, pit native-born American Protestant, these Yankees' vision of who people should be and how they should act against this immigrant sort of resisting and wanting to perpetuate its ethnic values, that being sober is in fact an innate character or an innate sign of your character, that you are you understand the responsibility of government, that you are someone who can be counted as responsible, and that it really is not just about, you know, these sort of what we think about when we, you know, we want to establish prohibition, but it's in fact deeper than that. And for the Midwest, it becomes, again, part of this, how do we understand Midwestern political culture? So for a lot of the Midwestern suffragists, these Yankees, they're not only suffragists, but they're also members of the WCTU. And they see their suffrage as coming out of, many of them come to suffrage, in fact, through the WCTU. In Iowa, in South Dakota, in Minnesota, they have tons of overlap. In fact, the South Dakota, the first state association, the leaders are basically the one and the same. They're the members of the WCTU, the state organization. So they cannot be separated in some ways. This becomes problematic when you start to have voters who are anti-prohibition, who are making this case that, well, all women want to do is get the right to vote so that they can establish prohibition. It's hard to say that that's not wrong because so many of these women are saying that. It's very difficult for them to try to downplay that. It's one of the issues that starts to really agitate the leaders of NASA, Susan B. Anthony in particular, Carrie Chapman Catt also later, because they're trying to make women's suffrage a single issue and they can't in the Midwest. It's just so difficult to do that, in part because so many of these women see themselves as suffragists because of their civic engagement and their community activism out of, in many ways, the WCTU, Federated Women's Clubs, and others. So they can't separate. They don't want to do that, don't want to make that argument that Anthony and Kat will want them to do. So it creates this big problem. But temperance is right alongside women's suffrage as a way of people in the 19th century, 20th century, of trying to understand how do we think about all of these groups of people who are vying for political power? How do we draw the lines? How do we make it clear who should be participating and who should not be participating? And so it's a way of trying to, as they start to advocate and have these campaigns, of starting to make a clear argument about citizenship, who are good citizens and who are not. And as you expect, if you're thinking through all these different groups that we've been talking about, really it's Yankees, native born, white women, they are good citizens. And these immigrants, and in particular Germans, are not.
I was thinking about the flip side of that too, which is that you have these German immigrants who can vote and who, for whom they're seeing this idea of women gaining the right to vote as, well, they're going to use that to force their values down our throat. And so why should we support this? And so then I think in terms of their women, they're thinking in terms of the Yankee women.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They don't want women to vote, a lot of them, in part because of these cultural gender norms that they have. But also, yeah, they don't want these Yankee women who are saying, well, we are good citizens. We understand this and we want the right to vote. And we have these ties to the WCTU. These German immigrants were like, well, obviously we're not going to support this. This is not in our interests. It does not align with our own values. So we're not going to support women getting the right to vote. And it starts to really drive a wedge over, you know, the late 19th, and really as you start to think about getting approaching World War I, it becomes a really big issue. But it also complicates a lot of the historiography. So much of the evidence, especially the evidence that comes from these national suffrage leaders like Anthony and Kat and Shaw, they just, you know, they do not like the Midwest. They do not like a lot of their campaigns. They did not go very well, at least the early ones in particular. And so they really, you have to read between the lines, especially the multi-volume History of Woman Suffrage that they produce as they're engaging in women's suffrage campaigns. They're not favorable or friendly when it comes to the Midwest, but it's pulling back the layers, you realize, well, it's because they have these prejudices and they have the sort of this insurmountable, as they understand it, sort of tangled mess of temperance and women's suffrage and immigrants who can vote with first on their first papers with what's called alien suffrage. And so they just see it as untenable. And for a lot of this period, especially after initial failures that they felt were just, you know, sort of inexcusable, they, in many ways, these national leaders turn their backs. And so for me, whereas in other states, especially Western states, the WCTU could be quite helpful at creating networks of activism for women suffragists to sort of work alongside them. In these states in the Midwest and really across the Midwest, that didn't work. Those networks of activism were not necessarily enhancing, but in fact, enhancing in a way of like bringing more people to the ballot or to the cause of women's suffrage, but it was in fact limiting the way people understood why they should support women's suffrage or not.
You described the frustration that national leaders felt, and I was thinking about the campaigns you describe in your book in the states, and I was thinking, which must they have found more frustrating? The early ones in which they came up, you know, short of the vote by a lot in the elections, or the ones you described that are later on, where they are so achingly close to achieving success, and yet it's like, you know, Charlie Brown in the football. It's like every time they seem to run into these campaigns, it's like, we're actually going to get there, and then they just fall short, and and they're right back where they started.
I know, it's like 5,000 votes and they're just shaking their hands. You read their letters and you feel the emotion. One of my favorite lines is after the 1916 campaign in Iowa, and the president of the Iowa Equal Suffrage Association, a woman named Flora Dunlap, she just says, these results were very bitter. You just feel it. She just spends a lot of these letters. She's writing to Carrie Chapman Catt at that point and just saying, like, we worked so hard for so long. We thought we had it, and we didn't. And in that case, they lost by about 10,000 votes. And then there's these accusations of irregularities in the election returns. Sounds very similar to some current conversations that we've had are having. But yeah, so in some ways, it's so interesting to compare the earlier campaigns. There's state campaigns in South Dakota in 1890. There's a brief one in 1894 that doesn't get much play, but then the next big one is in 1898. And I think the frustration was that they felt that no matter what they did, they weren't going to win. And they got very sort of downhearted very quickly. And then, especially in the 1890 campaign, I think Susan B. Anthony and Anna Howard Shaw and Carrie Chapman Catt, in some ways, they still kept fighting, but they had sort of lost that spirit where they just sort of knew it's not going to work. These people, we keep talking to them, and they just aren't going to support this, because for a variety of reasons, right? They're immigrants. They don't speak English. A lot of them had just been arriving into the United States. They have interests that would be against women's suffrage in that they are anti-prohibition. And so those, I think, they tried, but they recognized that it was really going to be futile. In the latter campaigns, in South Dakota, there's campaigns in 1910, 1914, 1916, and then in 1918, which is, that one's a little bit different because it took place during World War I. But then also the one in 1916 in Iowa, those become increasingly closer. And I think for them, they keep thinking, like, is it going to be this one? Okay, no. Is it going to be the next one? No. And they just keep thinking it's going to happen, but it's a matter of when. How many more years do we have to wait? I don't know which one would be more frustrating, but they're, in many ways, the ideas, the frustrations are similar from the earlier campaigns to the latter campaigns. But I think it's, in many ways, their approach is the sort of telling feature that gets at sort of how they understand their prospects.
I was thinking also, though, about how it wasn't just a matter of winning the votes. It was how sometimes the goalposts would be moved. You described how in Minnesota, for example, how early on the process, the state legislature decides to change how the criteria for an amendment being introduced into the Constitution from being a majority of the people support, who vote on the proposition to approve it, to it has to be a majority of all the voters in the election, and how they instantly, it goes from being something that is at best a long shot to something that is, oh my goodness, it's just simply not going to happen. And just the sense as to how, you know, they're climbing uphill and yet they're sliding back down faster than they can climb.
Exactly. Yeah, that Minnesota case is it. What it does is, and what it gets at is what I was saying earlier with that conversation with Dorothy Schweder about how what I wanted to try to do was look at people experience women's suffrage so much differently based on these political cultures and expectations. And so in Minnesota, there is no amendment campaign because of this crazy not so crazy, but crazy. To them, they didn't think it was crazy. Amendment rule where, yeah, if you basically what it means is if you vote no, or if you don't vote, it's a no vote because you have to get the majority of all the votes cast in an election. Well, the leaders, once this is passed in 1898, the leaders of the Minnesota Women's Suffrage Association, as well as NASA, they just sort of say, well, it's not going to happen for Minnesota. Not in the way that we've been thinking that it would with these kind of a state amendment campaign. It's got to go through the legislature at this point, which they knew the Minnesota legislature was highly unfavorable to women's suffrage. And really what you see in Minnesota is stagnation. It really wasn't a vibrant movement in comparison to what it was in South Dakota and in Iowa, as it was in Minnesota. But that really kind of, it's the nail in the coffin, right? They just can't, they just say, this isn't going to work. And so as a result, women living in Minnesota, you know, miles away, again, these sort of three counties are not that far from each other. But in Minnesota, their experience with women's suffrage was profoundly and markedly different than it was in South Dakota and Iowa. They just didn't have the kind of engagement or interaction with the ideas of women's suffrage, the questions about women's suffrage, as they did just across the border in Iowa or in South Dakota. And it's because of this really fascinating change to the Minnesota Constitution and amending it.
You, in your coverage of the suffrage campaigns, you break them into separate chapters, and you use 1900 as the dividing point. And that, of course, brings up the question of how progressivism changes the nature of these campaigns. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain a bit the evolution of the context in these campaigns and how that evolution helped to go from these initial 2-1 defeats on suffrage amendments, ballot measures, to where it started becoming much more narrow and victory seemed to be so much closer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. I did that certainly on purpose. There's a great sort of periodization argument that we can talk about within how this plays out. I will say the latest research on women's suffrage does a really nice job of talking about continuities, that there's this argument that there's this period from about 1900 to 1910 of the doldrums. And I think that the more current day scholars are correct in that that's not accurate, that there is continuity, but you're right that progressivism changes the context. And in particular in the Midwest, it changes the way people start to reevaluate the gender norms and gendered expectations for women. And it also changes the ways in which women can even more engage in the kind of public sphere and this civic responsibility that they start to talk about more and more. It starts to change that calculus. And so they really start to see themselves within this progressive movement as closer to the state, which is something that lots of people have talked about. They also start to see, though, that the state can, in fact, act on those things that they've had these longstanding interests in. So education and literacy and sanitation and public health, these are all things that these Midwestern Yankee activists had been engaging with and promoting in their local communities since the late 19th century. But all of a sudden, what progressivism gives them is kind of new language and new set of expectations for how they can even more publicly engage and with more authority engage with the state. And so in the Midwest, we see lots of new expectations in the state legislature. We have progressive governors in Iowa, South Dakota, and Minnesota that are elected at various times, but that start to pass bills that will, in fact, enshrine measures that Yankee activists had been advocating for before, but, you know, earlier through Federated Women's Clubs or the WCTU or what have you. So in many ways, they see that also as sort of vindication that the things that they have been doing for much longer than progressivism as a movement had been around are finally getting traction in the state and at the federal level, these state governments. They think, well, this proves that we should have the right to vote, that this proves that our political engagement is valid and influential and matters. And they see the tangible results. You know, they see that their children are healthier, and their streets are cleaner, and they have public parks. And so they're doing all these things with kind of a renewed vigor and energy. I do think it's important to say, like, there, it's not that progressivism makes them suffragists or makes them activists. They already were beforehand, but it just enlivens, it magnifies what they'd already been doing.
And yet they aren't quite over the finish line. And that brings us to the First World War and that sort of that catalyzation that takes place with the ultimately with the 19th Amendment. And this is where I thought it was very it brings us back to that early part of your book where you're talking about this notion of citizenship. How does the war change the circumstance in those states to where they're finally seeing movement? Because as you described, you go from the suffragists coming up short in campaign after campaign in the late 19th, early 20th century, to where in these three states, they're among the first to ratify the 19th Amendment when it comes before them.
I know. Yeah, when I talk about this with people, they're just sort of like, what? how do you change in a matter of 18 months? And in part, I mean, there's many reasons, but it's World War I that totally reconfigures how people are thinking about citizenship and the expectations of citizenship. They're thinking about immigrants, and in particular, German immigrants in the Midwest. So it starts as early as 1914, even though the United States has not been involved, you know, it's not a participant in World War I. There's lots of conversations, agitation around this question. And one of the things that's really important for the Midwest to remember is that they have this huge immigrant population, but also by this point, by 1914, Germans are the largest immigrant group. And many of these Germans are very eager to support Germany, and they make their case early on. And this really starts for the native-born, the Yankees in the Midwest. It really starts to turn what was sort of this tension that they had been willing to live with into more focused and overt nativism, anti-immigrant sentiment. And so that starts to then reconfigure how they're thinking about this idea of citizenship, where you had alien suffrage, you had immigrants who could vote, but not necessarily be citizens or complete the naturalization process. You had these, what they thought were these wonderfully civically engaged native-born women, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, who fit this particular mold, who don't have the right to vote. And they start to get this sense that they need to really develop and articulate clearly what they mean by citizen and citizen engagement. And so they start to do that over the course of 1914, 1915. And then by the time World War I, by the time the United States joins it, you have this massive shift toward support for women's suffrage. What we see in particular is those campaigns in 1916 in Iowa and South Dakota, they're quite close. But you already start to see the sort of nativism seeping into the analysis of the reasons why these campaigns failed. Earlier campaigns failed because of a variety of reasons. So it would be temperance, or it would be that there wasn't enough a ground game. There wasn't enough work that what suffragists had done. By 1916, that starts to change. It's not that the suffragists necessarily came up short, and that's part of it. But they start to say there are these nefarious elements at play, these really Germans, these ignorant voters who are sort of voting against women's suffrage because they don't want democracy to flourish and continue to work. And so these sort of it's almost like conspiracy theory, but and it's sort of subtle, but you see it in the suffrage propaganda, you see it in their letters, that they're starting to take these long, decades long arguments and put them into this new context about citizenship. And really what it does by the time World War I unfolds, it becomes civic responsibility, patriotism, that you understand that you are a responsible citizen, you have the obligations of citizenship, and that therefore means that you're patriotic. And in that context, if it's about loyalty and patriotism, women suffragists are on the right side and these German immigrants are on the wrong side. And that's really where we start to see that movement, that profound and pretty quick shift towards support for women's suffrage, because the suffragists will then use that argument to say, you need to give women the right to vote, to protect democracy, to uphold this idea of who is most fit to be a citizen and engage by voting. And you need to really get rid of this alien suffrage in these states. And so it's just this fascinating, all these sort of longstanding tensions really come to a head so quickly, 1917, 1918. And then in the case of South Dakota, women get the right to vote 2 years before the amendment is ratified. So the federal amendment. So it's just incredible how quickly that happens. And then, as you said, the first states to ratify the 19th Amendment, more than half, about half are from the Midwest, a region that the national leaders had written off a couple decades before.
I was thinking if Susan B. Anthony had lived to that point, she might have passed away from shock.
I don't think she ever would have anticipated that the profound support that these Midwesterners, that she had, again, she in her letters and in her, she just despised it after the campaigns that she had endured. She just despised it in many ways.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. So one of the things that has intrigued me in doing this project is this question about naturalization of immigrants and the assumptions that we have that we need to investigate further. And these assumptions about immigrants and the naturalization process, in particular in the 19th century and early 20th century, one of the things that suffragists will argue, and many people will argue, Anna Howard Shaw, in fact, articulates this in a speech that she gives in South Dakota in 1914. She says, all these immigrants are coming to the United States. They are taking out their first papers, which are the Declaration of Intention, which is after 2 years, but they're not finishing the naturalization process. So in these states that have alien suffrage, they can vote and never be citizens. And for me, I find that so interesting. Is that actually true? And so my question has turned into a second project, is to actually investigate the naturalization process and the enforcement of it, and to really look at the meanings associated with the process of naturalization, and really underlying that assimilation, because that's really one of the arguments that suffragists are making. So for me, it's this question of, if you go through the naturalization process, you get your citizenship status, what does that mean? How do people understand that at this time, late 19th and early 20th century? And what does that tell us about the assumptions we have about people coming to the United States and trying to join it? What are our expectations? They're not clear. that's for sure.
Are you looking at it again in terms of the Midwest region, or are you looking more broadly?
Yeah, I'm gonna keep it in the Midwest. I think there's so many just vibrant questions here that just keep captivating my attention and keep coming back to it, especially because of the particular way in which it was settled and how it was settled, the particular patterns and expectations that emerged. So, but I do think it'll be broad. I will be thinking about naturalization, certainly as it shifted from being something that was more of a state and even local matter to something in particular after 1906 that was a federal matter. And I just think there's so many assumptions that we have about what we expect for people who go through this naturalization process at this time, that, and in particular, knowing that in local communities, there was so much opportunity to not necessarily maintain there was a lot of opportunity to maintain their ethnic identities in the Midwest. I'm just very curious to think through that with more more time and more emphasis on that particular question.
Well, it sounds like an excellent project. Best of luck with it.
Thank you.
Sarah Egge, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks a lot.